Welcome to the Gary and Kenny Show. Yes, all the good titles were taken. I'm Gary Kroger, coming to you from Waterloo, Iowa, and I'm joined, as always, with Kenneth Seisler. Kenny Seisler in Calabasas, California. Hello, Ken.
Hey, I realize it's Kenny from Calabasas, California.
Yeah, that's you. How are you?
Thank you. How are you?
Well, I'm very good, thank you.
I just had to turn off my music from Alexa.
Uh-huh.
And I was about to turn around and tell her to turn off, and I forgot her name.
You forgot Alexa's name.
I forgot. I said, I couldn't remember. I should have asked Siri.
Do you think that this is early dementia? I mean, I don't want to go down this alley if you're not comfortable with it, but you think, are you okay? Can you make it through another hour?
And actually, what I'm curious about is, if you have dementia, you wouldn't know you have dementia. Isn't that like the catch-22 kind of a thing?
I don't know. Glenn Campbell sang a whole song about his dementia, and he sang it very well. So I think you know, because everybody tells you. You're forgetting everything.
Okay. All right. I apologize for this diversion. What's on the agenda today, Gary?
Well, we have a very special guest, and I think you know that, because he's a good friend of yours.
Every week it's a special guest with you.
Every guest is special, or we wouldn't have them on, right?
I see. Okay.
Well, our guest today, as you very well know, but our guests are about to know, our viewers, is Chris Meledandri. And if you're an animation enthusiast, as I am, you will know the name. Chris is a film producer and founder and CEO of the animation studio Illumination. He's responsible for the Despicable Me franchise, which looms large in my library in the viewing room in the basement, as well as The Secret Life of Pets. He supervised or executive produced Ice Age Robots. He adapted the Dr. Seuss books, The Lorax, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. It goes on and on. Please.
My God, he's been busy.
Isn't he something? Chris Meledandri. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Gary. Hello, Ken.
Hey,
nice
Chris.
To be with you guys.
So nice of you to be with us. Well, I'm going to go. Let's start this road down Chris's memory lane. I met Chris through our mutual friend, Mark Gordon, and he was at the time partners with Mark in a company cleverly called Gordon Meledandri. Am I right so far, Chris?
Yes, it would have been a little bit more clever if it had been Meledandri Gordon.
But yes.
Gordon Meledandri.
And I actually think that sounds better. Meledandri Gordon.
I did too.
Meledandri Gordon.
Yes.
And so that's how I first met Chris. Now, I do have this, I want to point out, because I just read an article about you, Chris, because I did a little research on you. And in the article, it put you down as one of the titans of animation. Now, that's quite a title to be a titan of animation, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
I know moguls. I know players.
Right. Now
you
know
the first titan that I know. Now, as a titan of animation, this is my first question to you. Can you draw?
No, not even. Not even badly.
Really?
No.
So if you want to show somebody how you kind of see this character, you can't say, oh, come over here. This is what I'm thinking. And
no.
Okay. All right.
No, I came at animation entirely through story. And when you met me, Ken, I wasn't even thinking about animation because I had barely seen an animated movie when I met you.
So given what you just said before, which is you had no background in animation, what was your feeling in saying, okay, forget about doing live action, I'm doing animation and I can't even draw? Were you like, this? I'm excited by it? You were apprehensive?
I was extremely apprehensive. It was, you know, the animation process has a lot of analogies to the live action process, but it's also very, very different. So when they asked me to take it over, I only understood about half of what I was seeing and hearing. And so I'm not a very quick learner. So it you know, I took it over and then it was really almost 2 or 3 years before I really started to feel comfortable and secure in what I was doing. I could apply all of my storytelling skills.
We'll dart around a little bit. I don't know that our audience really needs to go in a chronology here, but I saw you, it might've been a USC seminar. You're with Pharrell Williams and you're talking together about the process of collaboration. And he was simply in awe of you. It was a mutual admiration.
Well, he is a titan.
Yeah, well, but talk about that a little bit. I mean, you were talking about the fact that you were obsessed with some of his music. And were you thinking Despicable Me at that time? How did that process start with Pharrell Williams, for example?
My very first meeting with him, I was telling him the story of the movie. And I'm pitching my heart out in the story of the movie, and I see him, and he's like doing this.
Right.
And I had been in a few meetings in my career where you're pitching, and the person you're pitching to is on their phone texting, you know.
Right.
And his manager leaned over to me, and she said, whispered in my ear, she said, "Don't worry, he's not texting. He's actually writing a song based on what you're saying, what you're pitching to him." And he was writing what became the theme song of the movie.
It's a bad, bad day.
It's a bad, bad, yeah.
I'm having a bad, bad day.
Exactly, yeah. And so, so the relationship started, and we've never stopped working together. That was, gosh, 13 years ago. And we've continued to work together. He wrote probably 5 or 6 songs for the first movie and co-wrote the score. And then with Despicable Me 2, he again wrote another, 5 songs.
Chris, can I ask, is there a difference when you're reading a script that's intended for animation and one that's intended for live action?
But the big difference is that in an animated film, you're in a medium where you're creating everything out of whole cloth, right? So you can't, you know, it's, if you're making, you know, reading a script, let's say for Taxi Driver, they don't need to describe New York City, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in an animated film, even if you're setting the film in a real place, the expression of that place, the visual expression, the design of it is going to contribute to the story and is going to be distinctive and unique. And so the writer may not have those ideas yet. So the process is much more of a parallel process where you're developing script and visual design at the same time, and the two are influencing each other. So you end up with a script that looks pretty much like a live action script, but the process of getting there has not been so siloed just in the writing and the storytelling.
Let me tell you why Despicable Me stood out for me. It was the first time I saw an animated film tease the genre. In other words, it started with that theme song, "I'm having a bad, bad day." We've never heard the supervillain's thoughts before about why they choose the weapons they choose and all of these things.
The decision that led to what you responded to was first and foremost a decision to make an animated film about a villain as your protagonist.
Right.
That was where it started, right?
Brilliant.
And, you know, when I had grown up in those 70s movies, you know, a lot of those movies were about antiheroes in the 70s, a lot of American movies where you rooted for an antihero. And so we thought, okay, that would be really a cool approach to a protagonist, that your antagonist and your protagonist are the same character.
Well, how did Despicable Me come to you? Did it come in a pitch or a script or?
It was a remarkable confluence of events, because we had been talking about this, and just a few months into the existence of Illumination, I got a call from a woman named Nina Rappaport, who I had crossed paths with at Blue Sky, which was the company I purchased for Fox, the CG company I purchased that became Fox Animation. And she said, I'm coming to town with a Spanish animator named Sergio Pablos. And she said Sergio had been a formidable animator at Disney and then made a decision to move back to Spain and start a small studio. And he has a few ideas. And so I said, okay, well, I'd love to meet you guys. Now, at this point, it was, you know, I had gone from being the president of 20th Century Fox Animation to really working out of the back of my car. I had a deal at Universal that was paying all the bills, but I just hadn't gotten settled. And it was me and an assistant. And Mark Gordon was loaning me an office. And so I met with them and he started pitching me stories. And the third thing he pitched me was this story that he called Evil Me. About 20 drawings. Now, there were no minions, and the characters didn't look like the characters in the movie. But at the heart of it, he was telling me the story about a villain who needed three little orphan girls to help him pull off a caper. And those three girls looked at him and saw him in a light that no one ever had seen him in before, which was dad.
It was so touching.
A pure love for him that he had never experienced. And ultimately that love began to transform him. That core idea, even though the events became, you know, were very different, although there were certain scenes, I have to say, in Sergio's original pitch that made it into the movie. But that was the core of it. And it really was uncanny because all of a sudden, here's a story about an antagonist as your protagonist that showed up. And so I was like, oh, that I'm going to make that movie.
Well, you mentioned the minions. Now, the minions took on a life of their own. And I'm yes. seeing the minions. The minions are his minions. How did that come about? And what is the secret to the minions? Why have they transcended the films, in a sense? I mean, they had their own film, which I think was right. one of your biggest successes.
Yes. It was similar to how the Scrat came about in Ice Age. Because the Scrat, that prehistoric squirrel who's always chasing his nut, was never in any of the scripts. But with Despicable Me, we had a wonderful designer named Eric Guillon. And then I had two first-time feature directors, Chris Renault, American, but sounds like a French last name, and Pierre Coffin, who is French. And in this original story, the minions were envisioned like more stereotypic henchmen of great villains. And they were determined to try to find a new approach to a henchman. And so they started experimenting visually. So I became, you know, like the beneficiary of their combined artistry, which one day, you know, they said, we've been working on something. We want to show it to you. And there was something that you found an immediate appeal the moment. And then they started moving the figure. And so we started some early animation tests. And it was just one of those moments where you couldn't take your eyes off it. You just kept to watch it, even if it was just walking. I don't think I could tell you what the secret is, because I think it is really about an artistic expression that just happens to work. It's like, you know, why something is great.
Yeah.
But I do think there are a couple of observations that I can make. One is the fact that their design is so simple,
mm-hmm.
That there is an accessibility to that design, that you bring to it your own sense of depth and personality. It's almost like you're projecting onto it, you know. And I think the simplicity of that design invites that. And I think that the they're language agnostic.
Uh huh.
So that lives nicely with that very simple design.
Chris, I want to ask you this, because you went into animation without much background in animation. So now you're working with people who have a lot of background in animation, and sometimes they're like, well, who's this outsider? Because you kind of came in as an outsider. So now you come in as an outsider and you're expressing your opinions. Did you get pushback? Did you get people saying, you know, Chris, maybe you should do this or not that, or trust us? Did you get
kind of shut up?
Yeah.
Well, you know, yes, you always get varying degrees of pushback. And had I tried to do what I did in Los Angeles, I think it would have been extremely difficult coming in as an outsider. When I found the group in New York, they were a fringe group that were, you know, they were dreaming about making movies, but they hadn't animated anything longer than 2 or 3 minutes. And so they were brand new, in effect. I knew much more about films, and they knew much more about animation and certainly about the technology behind CG. So given that they were outsiders themselves, and I was that person who came along and said, okay, you know, do you want a shot at making a movie?
Right.
That was something that they'd only dreamt about.
Right.
So I was playing a role in their lives that was absolutely transformational. And then, you know, and then years later, when I found the group that I then acquired in Paris, because we have 700 people in Paris. That's where our movies are animated.
Well, you know, Chris, I told you I'm an animation freak. I love animation, and I'm not an animation purist in terms of, you know, I do consider Pinocchio and the Nine Old Men to be the Michelangelo of cell animation.
Right.
Plain cameras, that was state of the art. I still consider that Mount Olympus. But I don't make the judgment that computer animation, all right, what I'm trying to say is I see computer animation as the natural evolution. Walt Disney would have used it if it existed. Do you feel the same way, or do you feel that they are different? They're different crafts, but it's still a natural progression, in my view. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I do. But I also look clearly artistically. I think that there's absolutely room for both.
Do you think audiences can make the distinction between a hand-drawn animation and CG, or even?
Yes,
they do.
Yes. Yeah.
I know it, from my children. Go ahead, Chris. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, it's. Look, you could replicate cell animation with computers and not have any of it be hand drawn and probably fool a percentage of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But when we talk about CG animation, what we're really also referring to is these dimensional characters. It's a dimensional world. Even without 3D. So that, and there is, you know, very often, but not always, verisimilitude, which is the, you know, if you look at some of my favorite moments in our movies, you might have a there was a wonderful character in the first Despicable Me who ran the orphanage. And she's an absolute caricature, but unlike a cell animated, which is flat, you know, she's dimensional.
Right.
But then, so you see this caricature, but you look at her sweater and the detail on her sweater is damn close to photorealistic. And so there's that combination of taking a caricature and combining like surface elements that have realism give you a sensation and a sort of a suspension of disbelief that's different than watching a cell animated scene. It's not better, it's different, right?
What about the economies of a cell animation versus CG animation? Meaning budgets. Is it more expensive to do one over the other?
You know, today, could you make an exquisite animated, cell animated film for less money than an exquisite CG animated film? Today, you probably could. That has a lot to do with the fact that people there are less opportunities for traditional animators to make exquisite films. And so they would leap at the opportunity to do that because most of the costs in animation is labor. Right? Artists' salaries. It's not the technology, it's the salaries. So, but, you know, 2 years from now, there'll probably be a bunch of people who make a CG movie in their garage and it's going to look fantastic. They're going to have spent a fraction of what we spent.
So if you want to be in the animation business, you have to be fluent in computer-generated animation.
Well, look, as a generalization, I'd say yes, but up until very recently, you could have said that in Japan, Studio Ghibli only made cell animated films, and now and were dedicated to the traditional medium, and those films in Japan are routinely among the highest, you know, performing films. Everybody in Japan stops and sees, regardless of your age. You could be a grandparent. But now they're doing a CG film.
Now, speaking of artistry, the voice artist, you have been, I've heard you say, first of all, with regard to the Shrek franchise, you realized, you said something, we need the original actors. So that's another part of this artistry, besides the animation, it's the voice. Well, how do you voice cast? What is your process to bring that part of the collaboration together?
Well, we're first of all, we're very fortunate because we have one of our producers on our team has a fantastic ear. His name is Brett Hoffman. And he associate produced all the movies and now is executive producing a number of them. So what we do is we sit and listen to the voice. We do not look at actors acting. We just listen to the voice and we stare at a design, a static design of that character. And we just listen to, you know, to clips of that of that actor. And our team internally, we do most of our casting internally, unlike live action films that almost always have a casting director. We will sometimes use a casting director to help in specific instances, but largely everything's done internally. Our team will pull takes that could be relevant to what is to the personality of the specific character. And so we sit and we listen and we listen and we listen, staring, because, you know, you don't stop to really think about how much an actor uses their vocal instrument versus, you know, their reliance on their entire physical body and being. And so some actors just bring more to their voice in terms of energy and modulation, nuance.
Where? Okay. So where did Steve Carell, how did he come in onto your radar? Where did he find Gru? I think he once said, I'm Ricardo Montalban and Bela Lugosi. How did Steve Carell get involved? Because it was a perfect marriage.
Yeah, well, I had worked with Steve on Horton Hears a Who. He had played, he had voiced the mayor in Horton Hears a Who, which I had made back when I was at Fox. And when we sat down with to make Despicable Me and we said, oh boy, we're making a movie with a villain as our protagonist, we thought, how are we going to make this character likable? Because it's a great idea, but if we tip over into villainy too much, we may have an irredeemable character that the audience doesn't choose to root for, but falls back on their orientation that villains are bad. So the first conversation was, well, we need to find somebody to voice this role who is inherently likable, and that likability lives in their voice. And then we started from there talking about comedic abilities. And Steve just, that became the obvious choice for us. And he was our only choice. And we went to him and he responded. Now, prior to the first recording, he and I had talked and he said, well, you know, is there any input? And I had, you know, because Steve is so creative. Like he is a, you know, he is a writer when he's acting. Talk about understanding nuance. It's remarkable what this guy does with pauses and slight kind of emphasis on a syllable. I mean, he's a master. And he is, you know, a brilliant ad-libber. And so he said, well, is there anything that I should, that any input that, you know, you or the directors want to get? And I just said, look, Steve, you should feel free to go off and come in with whatever is interesting to you. And you know, I had had this experience once before with John Leguizamo, who I'd worked with on Titan and then an Ice Age. And with John, I had said, because he played Sid the Sloth in Ice Age, and he asked me the same thing. And John, who's, you know, incredibly adept at character creation, I had said, you know, I want you to participate in creating the character and bring it. Well, he sent us a tape of 45 different voices for the character of Sid, the Sloth in Ice Age. And now in Steve's case, Steve walked in and he said, with Steve, you always have to invite him to contribute multiple times because he never wants to step on anybody else's creative toes, the writers, the directors, but it was, no, Steve, we want you to do. And he said, okay, well, I've got something. Let me try it. And this voice came out. It was
remarkable. Was there remarkable. Any rendering visually that he saw? Did the picture come first a little bit?
There was an interesting thing about the design of the character, because it did come first, and when we first. Because what we do with animation is we don't send a script. We pitch the story to an actor with visuals and with a verbal pitch. And when we first pitched it to him, the design of Gru was very different from what's in the movie. And he fell in love with this design. And the design was lean and very dark, very sinister. And as we started working on the film before we recorded, we started to really worry about the ability to get that sinister design to be embraced by our audience. And so we had this idea. We actually had another character who we were contemplating as kind of like a head minion. And that character was round. And that character had, you know, round head, round body.
The amount of choices and options available when you make app animation are unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, it's limitless.
It's limitless. Yeah.
Right.
How long does it take? From the time you settled on making the movie to the time where it was released in theaters, what is that span?
Well, with Despicable Me is the shortest I've ever heard about for a major animated film. And it was 3 years and 1 month from my first hearing the original idea to it being in the theater. Normally, that period, if you're moving fast, you have to add about another year for the screenwriting.
And you're developing other animated movies while you're working on this.
How much is in the pipeline at one time, right?
Well, now there's quite a bit. So now, for example, today we have one film finished that's waiting because of COVID, which is our next installment in the franchise. So that's Minions: The Rise of Gru. It's a prequel to Despicable Me and a sequel to the last Minions movie. We have the sequel to Sing in production. We have an original film in production. We have an adaptation of the Japanese 40-year-old game Super Mario.
Oh, right.
Right.
We have that in production. And then we have the next installment of Despicable Me in pre-production.
But a lot of those sequels, a lot of the big creative moments.
Five.
Right. But in those sequels, a lot of the big creative decisions as far as what the characters are going to look like and how they're cast, that's already been set up. But when you're doing an original, and I know what's going on with Super Mario, but I'm sure there's a lot of attention being paid to that as to, you know, how are they going to look and with this sign. I mean, I can't fathom when you're starting from scratch. Not with sequels, but when you're starting with scratch and you go, should it be a blue coat, a red coat, a green coat? Should his nose be like this? Should his face be like this? Should his voice be like that? The trillion number of things that you have to talk about on a daily basis, it seems like, wow, that's a lot of pressure. And especially because it takes, if you come up with an idea, it's not like you could automatically bring the actor down and say, okay, can you try it like this? And he shows it to you. You have to have an animator go back and do the process, right?
Yeah, you know, look, we have wonderful directors who are, you know, every film has probably 400 or 500 people touching it, right? There's certain decisions that we make at the beginning, and then there are decisions that are being made all day long by our teams of writers and directors and animators and designers. And so, and then I'm looking at material myself, you know, 2-3 times a week, and then having discussions with the various directing teams. But when you're making something, you know, out of whole cloth, where yes, there are an infinite number of decisions. You know, the films are only as good as the talents of the crew who are working on them. And I think that the group of people we have right now, which is, as I say, the total number of people in the company is about 1,000. But I think that the people that we have now, while we have people from all over the globe, the lion's share of our artists are French. And I just think they're extraordinary.
Chris, the Shrek universe is on your plate too now, right? Will you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, when, you know, our company is based at Universal, and when Universal acquired DreamWorks, there was a lot of discussion with me about what role, you know, I would feel comfortable playing, and what I know about myself is that my interest lies in making things, not managing people, and I don't even think I'm particularly good at managing people, unless it's within the construct of a movie where everything is defined, you know. I decided that probably the biggest contribution I could make would be to help sort of relaunch the Shrek franchise. I've been fortunate that I've worked on a lot of franchises, you know, starting with Ice Age, and I'd like to think of what we did with the Seuss properties as sort of an animated Seuss franchise, and now Despicable Me, and we're heading towards Pets 3, and Sing 2 is fantastic. I love actually serialized movie making.
How far along is Shrek right now? How far along is Shrek?
We're just in the scripting phase. Mm-hmm. And I had an idea. And once I had that idea, I felt confident that we could really make a contribution to this.
Are the voices coming back? Do you have them all signed?
No, I haven't gotten to that place, but I don't anticipate any issues with that. I think everybody involved loves the franchise, and it's been a while. I think there are very few opportunities in the world today to make a movie that can command a global audience. Mm-hmm. And I think fewer opportunities post-COVID than pre-COVID. And I think that property is beloved. And I think that people will want to see it. And I think the people involved, you know, in making the original in terms of the actors are going to want to be part of it.
Well, speaking of a brand new world, a brand new issue is this idea that the actor who's doing the voiceover should match the ethnicity of the animated character. If you've had recently a couple of actors who said, okay, I'm not going to play that part anymore because I'm, you know, not of that ethnicity.
Apu, case in point, right.
What's your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, my thought about it is that I realized that I had a lot to learn about cultural appropriation, and that I wasn't in the best spot to sort of come into that conversation with a lot of personal experience about how cultural appropriation can affect people. And so I started to listen and really try to use it as an opportunity to be expansive in my own awareness. So we are very We're very disciplined now about respecting, you know, if like in Minions, The Rise of Gru, we have an Asian character, a woman who's in, you know, and you know, we only looked at Chinese actresses to play that role. You know, we look at it very, very carefully. It's, you know, it gets tricky because, you know, you also have design issues in animation. So,
right.
You know, you really, it's really important for there to be deep representation when you're exploring different cultures and different ethnicities, and the exploration of different cultures and ethnicities is an important part of how I see our storytelling. We're you know, very global in terms of the types of stories that we are intending to tell. So it's a very, you know, it's been, I think, especially, I think animation has had a tremendous expansive period in its awakening. And look, no better example than where animation's going than looking at Soul or Spider-Verse, which yes. are big steps in the evolution of inclusivity in animation, which I think is long overdue.
Mm-hmm. Well, very interesting. And, you know, animation, it lends itself to certain caricature-ness.
Yes.
Right? And so, obviously, that's maybe a challenge at times, right?
Without question.
Have you received any criticism? I haven't heard any, but is it something that you have to deal
we
with?
We have not, but it won't surprise me if we do. We are, our process involves, you know, a lot of awareness and around those potential issues. And we have instances where we definitely would opt to be less caricatured in order to be more respectful and are not going to ever let that sensitivity slip out of our process. It's you know, we're making a short film right now with a woman who's Chinese who came to America to go to CalArts. And you know, in a case like this, you know, it's a very personal film for her, so her depiction of Chinese characters is something that we totally leave in her hands.
I understood.
But if we have a character of a different ethnicity in, you know, Sing or Despicable Me, or, you know, we're going to be much more careful and include specific designers to participate in with those characters. Yeah, it's an issue. It's an issue that we really, I think the whole industry, you know, needed to become much more aware of.
I think so too.
Chris, there have been instances where animation movies have begot live action. Disney did it recently with The Lion King. I'm not really sure it was really live action, but that's what they called it. Yeah, I think The Jungle Book was animation, and then they made those into a live action. Is there any prospect or any of your properties that you go, hey, this might translate into a live action?
Not, it hasn't that hasn't not at this moment, no.
Okay.
You know, you always have to find what the, you know, what's the, these, even if you, as you say, Ken, those live action movies are largely CG movies of, you know, traditional cell animated movies. And you always have to kind of ask yourself, like, why are you doing it? What's the, and what's going to drive the creative team, you know, for multiple years to be truly excited about it? And I think that you need to have that spark and that conviction. And so I've not had that with any of our films.
Well, I know that Mark Gordon, our mutual friend, wants to go and become a Broadway producer. Perhaps he could take one of your minions, the minions on Broadway.
Yes.
It's going to happen.
Yeah.
Now, you talked about competition a little bit. Do you and John Lasseter play golf? I mean, is it a friendly competition in the world of animation? Do you look at each other's work? Do you share? Is there an outside collaboration in that respect?
Well, John is a unique kind of example, which is that he was supportive of what we were doing going all the way back to Fox. He did have a relationship with my director of Ice Age, but he was supportive of us as this sort of fledgling upstart. And that support translated into an attitude at Pixar that was, you know, was important to us because, you know, people would tell their friends, you know, if there wasn't a job at Pixar, go look over here, you know. And then when I started Illumination, John continued to be supportive. So he just never let that competitive spirit into the conversation. And he was, you know, he was the king of, you know, so, and we were the little guy trying to really actually brave the path that he had already pioneered. So, I've always been really appreciative of that. You know, Disney without John, it's come down more to sort of a marketing distribution competition because there's a number of release slots when you think about global releasing of films. And so we end up in situations where inevitably there are parts of the world where we're competing you know, look, they loom so large, but there are certainly instances where we've had to go head to head with them in Australia or, you know, we've done very well, but it's more of a competition in the sense that we're competing around release dates but you know, Disney, you just don't want to, my attitude is it's a company, regardless of how well we do, you just don't want to compete with them. They're so strong. And so you want to avoid competing with them at any cost.
The distribution's built in as well, right? I mean, it's a
band. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Let's talk about the future of movie theaters. I mean, there's nothing like going into a movie theater and watching an animated movie on a large screen. That's kind of over for a bit. We don't really know what's going to happen as far as movie theaters are going to happen. Mark Gordon speculated that all movie theaters will one day be known as an Amazon. You'll either go to an Amazon theater or a Netflix theater, and that will be it. Your thoughts on people getting back and watching these movies on the big screen?
I think that if you ask yourself about your own sort of pent-up appetite to become social again, even just in spaces, you know, I think it's indicative of a point in time when we're largely vaccinated, which I think will happen sometime around the summer. where people are going to go rushing back to social activity, concerts, restaurants, movie theaters. People are starved. You know, we're social beings. And unquestionably, the exhibition marketplace has been rocked, and we may lose screens. And some people may replace a portion of their movie going with in-home viewing. That's, you know, just part of an evolution of mediums. But I think that the return to the cinema, even if the cinema experience itself maybe evolves a little bit, but I think the return to the cinema will happen. I'm not sure there it will be on the same scale as it was pre-COVID, but I don't think it's going anywhere.
I agree.
Universal have a streaming service?
They have a service domestically called Peacock.
Right.
Which is kind
their
of
NBC stuff.
It's like the Hulu model, which is that there's a premium level with no ads, and then there's a free level. I think they're, I don't want to say around 30 million.
Do they have any kind of priority as far as Illumination films would be concerned?
Well, it's all, that's all being worked out right now in terms of, because, you know, if Netflix has 200 million and Peacock is fledgling at 30 million, there's obviously a disparity where we, together with NBC Universal, have to figure out what makes practical sense. But NBC Universal, Comcast is an incredibly strong company. And I think one of the reasons why it's so strong is that Comcast, while being a public company, has essentially, you know, a singular boss, Brian Roberts, whose father started Comcast. Mm-hmm. And so that it's an entrepreneurial environment. And his number for NBC Universal, Jeff Shell runs it, who is one of the most fearless human beings I've met in the film business and in life. And we all know what fear does to people in our industry. It makes it very difficult. And he just doesn't have that gene. It's like that guy who climbed, who did the rock climbing. They made that great documentary.
Right, yeah.
He doesn't have a certain... You know, he's missing a certain part of his brain. Right. And I think Jeff is a lot like that. So they're, you know, the company is got so many parts of it that are just incredibly successful. And I think that even though right now the full streaming picture hasn't yet defined itself, I have no doubt that it will in short order.
I want to just relate a story that I think is very revealing about why Chris is a success, if you don't mind me saying so, Chris. So I mentioned before that we met when Chris and Mark were partners. And I came in and I pitched an idea to them. Forget what the idea was. But when I pitched the idea, what struck me, and be quite honest, Chris is a very straight-laced kind of looking kind of guy, whatever. And it was very nice. But what struck me after I pitched it was he got so excited. Like a young, innocent person, he goes, I love that idea. That is so great. That is so terrific. And what people don't realize, and that's the thing about Chris, he has an innocence to him that when he likes something, he gets really excited about it. And that's why people love and respond to him, because it's like, you don't see it now, but when Chris sees something, he is truly... He gets like, wow, this is a great new thing. I love this. We got to do this. He's got incredible enthusiasm. And I would say to anybody who wants to know why people love to work with Chris and why he has the success is because he loves the ideas. He does. And he gets excited about it. And
Thank you, Ken.
I have a question, Chris.
Am I telling the truth?
Chris, yes. Do you remember his pitch that you were so excited about?
I don't remember what I ate for dinner last night. This is so
good.
I don't,
save.
Good save. Yeah, yeah.
I got to tell you, like I said, I'm an animation freak and I am a fanboy. I love your films on every level that you spoke of.
Oh, he's trying to get a hat.
No. Yeah, I'd love a hat. all of the nuance, the story, the characterizations, the music, the fact that you do turn the genre on its ear just a little bit. Every cartoon plays with the medium.
Yes.
Where others are afraid to a little bit. So
yes.
I've enjoyed this tremendously, tremendously. And I just thank you so much for being Ken's friend so that you'd come on. Because if I'd asked you, you would have said, what the hell? Who's this guy? No. But, you know, Ken, thank you for this wonderful pitch that no one remembers.
Well, you know, I got to say that there are a lot of people in this business who become very successful because they know – they're killers. They have that kill instinct. They're fearless or whatever the thing is. They're not nice people. I know a few people. So they're only my friends are. You know, there are nice people who finish first in the world. And I'm very lucky that I mean, Mark and Chris and other friends are, you know, genuinely great people. And they've achieved a great success. Well-deserved, and, you know, listen, I couldn't be more thankful that there are people like Chris and Mark and others in my life. So,
cheers, because you guys are 2 hours earlier. I've been drinking wine this entire interview because this is wine hour for me. So,
right.
Cheers. It sounds like we're wrapping up because that
I
was just
so.
Fuzzy.
Thank you, Chris, so much.
Close I've ever heard. Chris.
And by the way, can we get a hat?
Yeah. Love a hat. But ladies and gentlemen, I know you've been enjoying all of the interesting stories from Chris Meledandri, Illumination, Despicable Me, just being part of this incredible story. But I'm going to probably go downstairs after this and put a couple of those movies on and have popcorn. So thank you for watching. Chris, thank you so much.
Yeah, and thank you guys for being interested, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. So I appreciate the invitation to spend this time with you. So thanks so much.
That's very sweet.
And Kenny, am I one of those nice people in your world? I'm
absolutely,
just...
Gary.
Okay.
You're my top bro.
Okay, all right, okay. And I return that compliment. Thank you both, and thank you for watching. You'll find us on iHeartRadio, Pandora, YouTube, Apple Podcasts. We're all out there. Thanks for watching, and enjoy all of our episodes, The Gary and Kenny Show. We couldn't think of a better time. So long.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay.
Thanks, Chris.